This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, I'm Robin Williams, and welcome to another conversation, this time with someone who served at the pinnacle of both universities and business. Lord Oxborough, Ron Oxborough to his friends, has been head of the renowned Imperial College in London and chairman of Shell Oil. He was in Australia to attend the annual meeting of the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering and was on the science show saying some uncompromising things about climate change, and he repeats some of them tonight, but talks mainly about our energy alternatives. First, do we really have only 10 years left in which to tackle the consequences of climate change?
Well, it depends what the 10 years is to do. We've certainly got no more than 10 years to get our strategy in place for the next 40, because we have to keep global emissions down, ideally below 450 parts per million.
It's now 380.
And it's now 380, and that is going to be an enormous task. And given that it takes a long time to change infrastructure, a long time to get new technology in place, we really have to get our strategies now. And this has to be a double strategy, partly to manage our consumption, and the other strategy is to move away from technologies which have a high carbon footprint to those which have zero or low.
Well, let's examine some of those particular options in a minute, but there are still a number of people, including a colleague of yours in the House of Lords, Lord Lawson, who used to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, saying that it's not proven, that they've got lots of doubts, and it's a kind of panic stations needlessly from some sort of political motive. How would you answer people like that? And presumably you know him.
I do know him, and I have had exchanges with him on the floor of the House of Lords on this. I think that the climate change argument is absolutely conclusive. If one looks at atmospheric CO2 over the last 70,000 years, which it's now perfectly possible to do, looking at the composition of bubbles, air bubbles in ice cores and things like that, what you see is that 60 or 70,000 years ago, CO2 in the atmosphere was pretty low. It was around about 180, 190 parts per million. And then it trundled along, going up and down, until we came out of the Ice Age, around about 18,000 years ago. And then it rose relatively abruptly until about 150 years ago. And then it shoot right up, goes through the roof. Now, people say, well, all of this has happened before. Well, the fact is it hasn't. We've had CO2 excursions in the atmosphere, certainly as high as we see today, previously, but we have no parallel at all for the speed with which this has gone up over the last 150 years. Now, the next step in the argument is to match that spike in atmospheric CO2 with what we know we've put into the atmosphere from our burning of fossil fuels, which really began in a big way around about 150 years ago. And you can match the amplitude of the spike with what we know from historical records of fuel burning, what we've put in, and it matches very well. Now, the final step in the argument actually relates to old Arrhenius, the Nobel Prize-winning Scandinavian chemist, who in the latter part of the 19th century noticed that people were burning coal and predicted at that time that this would increase the greenhouse effect of the atmosphere and increase global temperature. And he thought this was a jolly good thing because he thought Scandinavia was both a bit damp and a bit cold. And he was all in favour of some global warming. But the point is that this is not a latter-day artefact dreamt up by scientists who want to keep themselves in business. This was something that was predicted by Arrhenius. And indeed, he got the order of magnitude of the rise in temperature we observed absolutely right. So I would say that in contradiction of my noble colleague, yes, Lord Lawson, to whom you referred, is that he's talking rubbish.
But the thing is, he is from the conservative side of politics and presumably a very intelligent man. He's got lots of contacts in business, and lots of people in business think, oh no, here comes another thing trying to undermine the kind of activity that we want to get on with. And we've seen them before, like the Y2K bug, you know, the thing about computers which came and went without trace. And they're concerned that we're being stopped from getting on with it yet again.
Well, I think, I mean, just to pick up the Y2K bug, the reason that it probably didn't cause any problem was that everyone had taken a great deal of care to ensure that it didn't. But I think, to go back to your more general argument, even if one is not bothered about climate change, which I find hard to believe, but even if one weren't, the fact is that we are no longer finding gas and oil in the quantities that we previously were. Oil discoveries and gas discoveries are declining. And so really what I'm saying is, even if you don't believe in climate change, there are other imperatives moving us away from oil and gas.
Sure. Now, in the 10 years we've got, we need to concentrate on various options. Which are amongst the most promising that you can see?
Well, what you've got to recognise is that different technologies have different timescales. And I suppose for those countries that can stomach it socially, probably nuclear energy is the most mature technology that can be implemented most rapidly. Now, if there is strong social opposition to nuclear, well, that will ensure that it isn't. But in terms of a mature technology, and I think today a reasonably safe and manageable one, that is the earliest thing to do. On the other hand, there is an enormous amount of coal around the world. And India and China are incredibly important in this story because they're poor countries, they have very little in the way of oil and gas, and they have a desperate hunger for energy. And they are going to be burning their coal. And coal is the dirtiest fossil fuel. And by that, I don't just mean particulates and atmospheric pollution. I mean that you produce more CO2 per unit energy than you do with any other fossil fuel. And frankly, managing climate change really involves managing the CO2 emissions, particularly from Chinese and Indian, I mean, in fact, indeed from all coal-fired power stations. But it's just that China and India are building them at such a rate and in such number that unless the emissions from those can be managed, we really don't stand much of a chance.
It's something like a couple of a week or every day.
Well, in China, the estimate is a gigawatt of coal-fired power every 5 days, which is prodigious.
That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so if you've got that sort of emission of carbon, how do you feel about the carbon-saving technologies, the carbon capture that's talked about? Isn't that a long way off as well?
All the elements of carbon capture have been demonstrated. What no one has done is actually put them all together in a working system to make a coal-fired power station as clean as it can be. And I think that is the importance of the initiative of the CRC for CO2, which the government and industry are supporting in the Latrobe Valley, where an existing coal-fired power station, quite a big one, is going to have carbon capture retrofitted. Now, this is a first, and this is going to be relatively expensive to do, would be my guess. And the trick is going to be to learn how to do this and do it better, and certainly cheaper. The trouble is that doing this involves a loss of efficiency in the power station and an increase in capital cost. And really reducing those effects is the big techno challenge. And I see it as a massive opportunity for Australia. Australia has a lot of experience to develop the technology for burning coal cleanly and then exporting that technology to China, to India and all of the other countries that will
want to. Can it ever be cleanly enough, however?
Well, it's an imperfect world. This coal is going to be burnt. India is going to burn its coal. China is going to burn its coal. And in an ideal world, we would have emission-free power stations. We're not going to get it, but it's an awful lot better than nothing.
Carbon sequestration, that is burying carbon underground in the CO2 form or under the ocean, that's still, what, 20, 25 years away, isn't it?
Oh, no. Oil companies have been putting CO2 underground for 30-odd years, basically not to get it out of the way, but simply as part of the process of enhanced oil recovery. You know, there will be oil in a reservoir which is quite difficult to get out, and I'm not talking of these big residues that I spoke of a moment ago, but there will be oil there that you want to get out, and you try to push it out by pumping water behind it, or sometimes pumping CO2 behind it. And the use of CO2 underground for enhanced oil recovery is very well understood. Now, when it comes to putting it underground to keep it there, this is a slightly different ballpark, in the sense that people will presumably be paid for putting it underground. If there is money involved, there's going to have to be some kind of certification or verification that not only has the CO2 been put down there, but it stays down there. And there will be a degree of bureaucracy about this, which has not attended, of course, the classical use. But there is, to answer your question, there is quite a lot of experience of liquefying CO2 and pushing it underground. And although there are undoubtedly things to be learned, I don't see that as the big problem. The big problem is at the power stations.
Yes, indeed. What about the promise of biofuels and biodiesel?
Well, I've been learning recently that biofuels have actually had a pretty rocky start for a variety of reasons in Australia. And I think that's very unfortunate, because worldwide, I believe, biofuels are going to be very important. At least what I would call second-generation biofuels. You know, it's for quite a long time, people have crushed the seed, crushed soya beans, palm nuts and things of that kind, and linseed, to make an oil on which you can run a diesel. And you can run a diesel to some extent on almost any oil, you know, from a chip shop or a fast fryer or what have you. Doesn't run very well. And really what you have to do if you're using one of these natural oils for this purpose is refine it very carefully to high specifications. And I believe that part of the problem here, when it was first introduced, that it was not actually refined to particularly exacting specifications. But there is another problem, and I'm simply talking about biodiesel now. There's a separate story on ethanol. On biodiesel, I think it's very important that, given the fact that the world population is steadily rising and, you know, predicted to hit 9 billion by 2050, it doesn't make a lot of sense to use a food crop to produce a fuel for vehicles. And I think that there are several other ways forward. One that I'm personally involved in is a company which uses nuts from the jatropha tree. And this is a tree which grows in tropical areas, and I believe that in certain states in Australia it's actually declared a weed. It grows for about 30 years and produces a nut. The nut is not edible. In fact, juices from the nut are a very strong purgative. but in fact, it grows in semi-arid, marginal land, and can be crushed to produce an oil which you can then refine to give you a good biodiesel. And there is a protein-rich residue, which again you can treat to feed animals. And this little company that I've just become involved with, I'm really quite impressed. They've created something like 200,000 jobs, part-time jobs worldwide, in five different countries: China, India, Thailand, South Africa, and so on, where there were no jobs before in this really very arid country, simply looking after these plantations. So I think the kind of crops that one must think of ought not to be in competition with food. And that's the diesel. And I would emphasise that quality control refining is really very important there.
Now, of those various options, we seem to have a good swag. What would you see the role of the renewables, really? Is it going to be anything like a useful proportion beyond the small amount that, for instance, the Prime Minister John Howard refers to as being, you know, within the 2 to 5 to 6%?
Well, I think if you look at renewables in general, and let's leave biofuels to one side at the moment because we've talked about those, I classify the renewables two ways: continuous renewables and discontinuous renewables. And by continuous, I'm thinking of geothermal, I'm thinking of hydro. And those are going to have a full role where they're available. But then if you think of the discontinuous renewables, you've got wind, waves, tide, and sun. Now, all of those are part of the Earth's dynamic system, but they don't function all the time. And this means that, unfortunately, as things stand, they have to have some backup associated with them. So they're useful, but they're not an answer in themselves. Now, all of these would be transformed if you had a means of storing electricity, which would mean that you could store electricity from the wind when you didn't actually need it and save it for the times that you did need it, and the same with solar and so on. And if you can store that electricity, you can make one of these intermittent sources look like a power station, which is there whether you want it or not. So I think that there is now a technology on the horizon which may actually do this. And I don't know if you've come across this. This is the redox flow battery. It's built around a fuel cell in which you have two different electrolytes. And the way this thing actually works is that when you feed electricity in, you pump electrons in. And when you draw electricity out, you take electrons out. And you just change the balance of the electrolytes. Now, the beauty of this is that it has a very high efficiency. It's about 75%. You can scale it up more or less indefinitely. Its response time is milliseconds, so it's absolutely superb as a backup system. Now, I think there are at present three installations in the US which are operating on this, and the Irish government is now talking about taking half of its baseload electricity from wind, backed up by these flow redox battery systems. And if this really works out, as it looks as if it's going to, I think it could transform wind and wave and solar.
So giant batteries attached to these various sources.
Giant batteries.
When could they be ready?
Well, they're ready at the moment, and I think this company is going to be raising capital within the next couple of months. But I would say that unless unsuspected hitches emerge, this could be very important in 5 years' time.
Now, you mentioned briefly geothermal. And of course, in South Australia, we have a gigantic rock waiting to have water poured on it, which could provide something like a fifth of our needs, is continually running into hazards and lack of support for people who think it's almost too weird to back a hot rock underground, you know, a kilometre underground where you pour water. How do you view that as a potential?
Well, the problem with hot rocks underground is that somehow you have to get the heat to the surface. That should be perfectly possible. What you have to bear in mind is that hot water has a very small fraction of the energy content of oil. And what may be cost-effective in getting oil out of the ground might not be cost-effective in getting hot water out of the ground.
What you've given us is a wonderful array of options for the short time we have left. Do you think we're going to make it?
To be honest, I don't know. But the only way of ensuring that we don't is not to try.
Yes. Given your background as understanding the engineering, the geology, you're a scientist, but you've also been in business, of course. You've had the surroundings in Shell and elsewhere of people who really have to make fairly hard-nosed business decisions. Are you seeing them being now convinced of the need to get on with it, these people in enterprise?
I think people in enterprise are really satisfied there is a problem. On the other hand, their difficulty is there is not yet a business environment in which they can responsibly do what they think needs to be done. And all that business is waiting for is a very clear indication that governments are not going to get bored with climate change and simply go off and do something else in 5 minutes' time.
And there's tons of enterprise to be getting on with this. It's not as if you're going to be chopping the knees off business.
Absolutely. No, this is an opportunity. And I find it very difficult to understand that some businesses or some business interests, particularly in North America, but I have to say here in Australia from time to time, people see this as a threat. It's a prodigious opportunity.
Thank you. Lord Oxborough, former chairman of Shell Oil, former provost of Imperial College in London. He trained as a geologist. Next week, back to the old days, times when exploration took you to places on Earth no one had ever been to before. Is that era forever over? Is the romance of exploration at an end? That's next week at this time. You're on ABC Radio National, where it's coming up to 8 o'clock. I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. and we're live on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.